Colonel Featherby, Reel 8. Now, another thing is that recruitment has been an ever-present theme, the importance of recruitment and difficulties of recruitment and retention. Did Gunn introduce anything new, Gunn and yourself at that time as second in command, or did you just carry on and perhaps increase the vigour with which you...
We just carried on and increased the pressure on the battery commanders to bring their battery up to strength as best they could.
There was a prize offered but to the batteries of £5. It doesn't sound much now, does it? But
for a man, was it?
It just says £5 offered to the battery.
Probably £5 per recruit or something at that time, which was quite a fairly substantial amount of money, maybe. And I don't know how, I can't remember how well it worked, but we certainly did manage to get quite a few recruits in.
There was another exercise, exercise Merry Month at Stanford Primary Training Area. Do you recall that in May?
No, I don't.
Were you starting to lose your ex-Second World War veterans as we come into the early 60s? Or had you lost... I mean, some of them will have endured, some of the senior NCOs. Was this a problem that you were losing the war-trained generation, the generation that had been in action?
Yes. I don't think, however, that it necessarily affected the efficiency of the battery.
In what way?
It necessarily affected the efficiency of the regiment if we were getting some very good quality people coming in who were not necessarily ex-servicemen.
Were some of the older Second World War veterans not, although they had battle experience, there can be bad habits in battle experience picked up. But the other thing is that just old age brings its own inefficiencies. Were they losing their efficiency by the time they were leaving?
Yes, I think probably some of them were, yes.
So when you had replacement, young 20-year-old, that was in a way better or
yeah,
at least as good?
Yeah.
What, you were, again, turning back to the Queen's Cup, you were trying to compete for the Queen's Cup and the 425 battery seems to have come second in the fire-off. Would you go with them I presume it was Salisbury Plain,
yeah,
Lark Hill. Would you go with them as second in command at that time? Or
we went down, yes, but it was totally a battery orientated exercise. So it was really the battery commander who was in charge of the exercise. James was there, I was there, probably a lot of other people were there as well to watch it, because it was an exciting display of guns, and we wanted to win.
They came second at least once, and then another time they came second when they actually lost a gun. Do you remember that incident?
It hit a large hole and turned over, yeah.
Were you there? Did you
I don't think I was there at the time.
The next thing I want to deal with before we come on to the climax of the Queen's Cup is the changeover in colonels, which...
was some controversy in the regiment about who would take over from James. I think you refer perhaps to one's background in the earlier years, and I think that there were one or two people who were suggesting that my background wasn't strong enough to represent the South Lancers Arts in certain circles.
Now, what do you mean by who were these people, if you know, and what do you mean by not strong enough?
Well, the regimental background to the commanding officers was generally either from local landed families, because that was the historical background, Barbers and the Birkins and all the rest of it, either from industry or from landed people. And certainly all the other commanding officers were relatively wealthy people who could put their own money into supporting it socially if necessary. I got three problems, really. Firstly, I hadn't got a degree or a public school background. I had a wife at that time who had an alcohol problem, and she wasn't necessarily considered suitable to be a commanding officer's wife by certain people. And I don't quite know who took this plea. I just don't know. But the outcome of it was slightly different. And I've been born in a council house. I mean, you know, I don't think many people knew that at the time. So I was really, if you were looking at it from that point of view, and all the colonels were alive at that time, Barbara, Arthur Warburton, and they all were having a say as to how this matter might be resolved. But dear old James said, well, there is one way of resolving this matter, and that is the most efficient person should command the regiment. And he devised an exercise for us, the two contestants.
Who is the other contestant?
Paul Pollard, who's still alive, so one's got to be a bit careful what to the matters. Paul Pollitt and I were the two contenders. There was nobody else in the running at that time, really, because of seniority. And he devised an exercise in which he got shot, Paul Pollitt was given the morning, or I was given the morning, I can't remember which, and we were given an exercise to use the whole of the regiment. And on the outcome of that, which was really a test of efficiency, I managed to do it. And that was James' way of sorting out his problem. It didn't resolve any other problems that might have been in the background. But then it worked, and I was duly kind of made CO.
Now, this what was Paul Pollitt's role in the regiment? We haven't mentioned him before.
Paul Pollitt was a battery commander.
Which one did he have?
I think he had 4520.
And what was he like?
Paul was ex-AROP, got quite a lot of experience, a solicitor, well-known in Nottingham, obviously a nice chap, but a little bit ponderous. Want a better expression, and you'll have to talk to James about this because it was his plot. Now, there's no doubt about it that James had consulted all the other living COs, presumably the CRA and other people, the TA Association, about this problem. And I don't know who was for and who was against. And I don't particularly want to know either. But, I mean, I think there must have been a consensus of opinion that I was a good gunner and could do the job. And it was a question of the social side of it being perhaps a bit iffy.
Were you aware that he was going to suddenly pretend to be dropped shot at the exercise?
I have been told that this was where they were going to try and play it, yeah.
And Pollitt knew as well, so it was a level playing field for you both. And did you have any problems?
It went like an absolute dream. It really was the most exciting day.
Do you remember much about it?
I had a stiff drink before we started. I remember James said, yeah, have a stiff drink and a large whiskey we set up. And it worked like a dream, and the boys really came up trumps, and everything fired, and it went. And
were you there while Pollitt had his go, or was he there? I mean, were you there?
We were both there on the range. Yeah.
And what went wrong with his, relatively, or was
I think it was drastically wrong. I don't suppose it did go drastically wrong. Ask James. James was wrong very vividly the day, I'm sure.
Yeah, so it wasn't so much. It wasn't his disaster that Pollitt. It was that yours went better.
Yes, I mean I think it did go very well. Yeah.
Now, this is the same camp where you qualified for the Queen's Cup. 425 battery qualified for it. Yes. How, what did they have to do to qualify for the Queen's Cup?
There was an exercise set by the CRA, a battery exercise, a battery fire and movement exercise, and it was judged by the gunnery staff.
What were the criteria they used?
I think that probably what they were saying was time and efficiency and rounds on the ground in the right place. Because we went at a fair gallop all the way around the exercise.
And the firing off that year, what do you remember of that? That this is the one they actually won.
Yeah, although eventually the last three, I think it was three batteries who were chosen to actually compete in the final, we would then have another long weekend, and we did a further exercise, and the South Knots were successful.
Had you actually taken over by then, or was it still the last?
I didn't take over until after camp.
So and that's when you went to in this program you went
yes.
to.
And then of course, unfortunately, because James had handed over to me, he didn't go and collect the prize. I went to collect the prize.
But you took him with you.
Yeah.
Now the other thing is, you mentioned the battery won something else as well.
I realised that we won the National Artillery Association Cup. That's the Queen's Cup. And I don't know quite what that was awarded for.
Was that for the same thing?
I'm not certain.
Right, well, we'll perhaps leave that. Now, when you took over as colonel, was there a new broom approach, or were you, how did you feel about taking over? Because you'd been quite an admirer of James Gunn, and from the sound of it. What did you decide to do when you took over yourself? That would be in around about August 66.
Well, I didn't really want to change anything because we got hanging over us the possible reorganisation of the Territorial Army. So I really didn't command the regiment as a gunner regiment for many, many months before we were kind of stood down as gunners. And we reformed as ABR3, Home Defence.
Well, this then is the time to what I false started before. What about the reorganisation? This is based on the whole analysis of the role of the Territorial Army that the government had done, and its division into these three categories. Can you give us a bit of a background as to how it affected you and the South Knots as
well? I mean, it affected us very severely because, in fact, we had our guns taken away from us. And we were formed up again as a home defence force with light weapons like rifles and signal equipment and light vehicles.
As infantry?
Infantry.
And how did this affect you? And I mean, what did you think of all this?
Not a lot. In fact, we did lose quite a few people at that point in time who went to other units which retained their proper territorial association with regiments. I mean, they would still retain some signal regiments as signal regiments. And we did lose a number of people to that particular type of unit. We trained quite hard at home defence.
So you had no guns at all?
Yeah.
Was it home defence or civil defence or the same?
Home defence. Really.
What is a home defence role? What is the role you were given?
Well, I mean, it was really to defend the UK only in the event of we're talking a lot about parachutes. The parachute is dropping and the Russians coming over and dropping parachutes and all this kind of nonsense and guarding key points, and it wasn't a very sensible kind of an arrangement, I don't think. It was very difficult to get enthusiasm going for it. But however, we did, and this was the great problem. We recruited very, very hard indeed, and we were, at the end of the day, the highest recruited ADF regiment in the United Kingdom.
Now,
we had something like 404 of all ranks at Bulwell in the ADR3 regiment.
Now, what did ADR3 mean? Could you explain what that was? Or was it?
It was a category. I don't know what ADR actually stood for.
What did it essentially mean, though?
It meant to us that we were a home defence regiment and no longer a gunner regiment. There were other units that retained their territorial equipment as territorial regiments, but as far as we were concerned, we were home defence.
Now, how had you done such a good job of recruitment in view of the problem, the fact you'd lost your guns, you'd lost any sort of exciting role?
We just worked very hard at it. I felt that if we had a very strong regiment, it would be very difficult for us to be subsequently got rid of. And that, of course, came about later when it was proposed that we would be taken down to Carter strength, and then the battle joined with those in authority to decide a future for us. I mean, we eventually, like lots of other organisations in the TA, were not paid, and we were kept in limbo for some months by Harold Wilson and his government. And at that time, we put together a volunteer unit who went to camp for a week at Walkop.
Now, so that was in 1967, and then 1968 again you went to Walkop. When the unit was first cut down to this infantry sort of miscellaneous home defence AVR3 role, how did that affect your job as colonel? Because it sounds like you were almost overranked for it. You know,
we still had three batteries. We still had three battery structures. We had three battery commanders who, again, were responsible for maintaining their strength as best they could.
So although you were infantry role, you still had a battery structure?
Yes.
Were you aware that there were inconsistencies and illogicalities about what was going on?
Yes. It didn't strike me at the time that it was a formation that could continue in the longer term, because either we were going to gradually lose interest in it, or the role really wasn't one that I felt that at that time the government could sustain in terms of national interest.
In what way? What was wrong with the home defence role?
Well, it was so out of date.
In what way?
It would have been more sensible to have had a home defence role earlier in the 50s and 60s, when the threat was much greater than it was in the late 60s.
So what? I mean, I know you wrote a letter later on during the Carter affair, and we'll come on to that. But so what were you doing as colonel during 1967 to try and sort things out?
All I was really doing was to try, my enthusiasm, I suppose, if you like, kept the thing going, alive and kicking. I mean, a lot of the regiments went down the drain as far as recruiting was concerned, because I didn't see a lot of enthusiasm for it, and particularly those regiments where they were in different locations. Luckily, we had this great advantage of being in one drill hall. So, there is such a thing as critical mass. I mean, the trouble with the officer's mess at the moment is that it isn't a critical mass to be an officer's mess with 12. You can't have a proper party with 12 people, of which some are in London and somewhere else, and you barely get about five on a night. But we were lucky to we could get everybody in the same drill hall, and we knew one another, and Sergeant Mess was strong, and we kept it going.
And so how did you try and keep enthusiasm up? I mean, just by force of personality or what?
To some extent by force of personality. We tried to do exercises on training areas like Proteus and wherever we could. There was a certain amount of land lent to us by landowners around Nottinghamshire who we used for infantry-type training exercises.
Now, what sort of things did you do on these training exercises, and how did you know much about what they were doing? It's been a long time since you'd done your infantry.
Absolutely. We didn't know an awful lot about it, to be perfectly honest with you.
Were your PSIs still from the artillery?
No. We had an adjutant type person who was civilian employed. He was an ex-major in the Lincolnshire Regiment who we took on as a kind of administrative officer to keep us going. He turned out to be an alcoholic, so we had difficulty with him. We eventually had to get rid of him. But
what was his name?
His name was Lee. Quite a well-known Grantham family.
Major.
It was a crazy kind of setup, really.
So, who was your second in command?
Well, Paul Follett stayed on as my second in command. And then eventually we had Major Lee as a kind of administrative officer.
Were you able to work well with Paul Pollitt?
I mean, yes. We got on very well with one another. Yeah, we knew one another in business. Yeah, no problem.
And so, as this year went, the training camp was, I think, at Walcop. This is the 67 training camp. Do you remember much about that camp? It was only a week as an AVR. It says two, but I think it means three unit.
Yeah.
What sort of training would you do there?
Well, it was small arms training, because at that time I think Walcop had been converted into an infantry training camp. Rifle firing, small arms. Is this the one where we went as volunteers?
No, it's the year before. I think you went twice to Walcop. This is the first one, which is where you,
yeah.
It was a proper camp,
yeah.
Before the government had suspended you.
Yeah.
Well, was it a successful camp?
I can't remember. I suppose it was, because we didn't show any great problems. Didn't seem to show themselves in the losing men.
Now, I want to talk about honorary colonels. We've not really talked about honorary colonels now, but I think yours was Warburton.
Yes, it was.
Can we ask about the role of, and you can look previously to the previous ones, which are people like Barber, the two Barbers, and other major figures. Foreman Hardy was an honorary colonel as well for James Gunn, I think.
Yes.
What did you think of the role of honorary colonel?
The honorary colonels, well, it is a rather strange kind of appointment, because I was one myself, ultimately. You are there to advise, you are there to keep an eye on CO, and you're there to help the succession of the regiment.
Now, I want more to look at when you were the colonel with the honorary colonel as Warburton. How did, do you see what I mean, looking at it from that side, how did you feel as a commander of the regiment with the relationship with this outside honorary figure that nevertheless had some power over the regiment? How did you get on with Warburton?
Well, I got on with him very well. I mean, we were in a great difficulty at that time because of the uncertainties of what was going to happen to us. He had a number of contacts in the gunner field from his previous experiences. We met quite frequently over the question as to how we could ensure that the South Knots Hussars continued in some form or another, and he was very helpful. Gave me good advice.
So he didn't interfere?
No, no. I mean, I've known him for a long time, you know. We, all of us, have got, only got one thing in mind, that is the future of the South Knots Hussars, and still have today. And when things go wrong, we all gather around, you know, and can you do so-and-so? Can you do that? Do you know somebody who will bring a bit of influence to bear?
Now, you were, you know, a lot of you are businessmen, quite practical, hard-headed businessmen in your private lives, and, you know, responsible senior professionals. It was only part of your life. Why was it important that the South Knots Hussars survived? Why couldn't it have just been another unit without that vital South Knots part?
Well, I mean, I suppose I was joined in 49, and it was about 69, or 20 years in my life being devoted to furthering the cause of the South Knots Hussars. I spent a tremendous amount of time at weekends, drill nights, with a young family and all the rest of it, going to Bulwell, training, coming back again. And indeed, when I was handed command of the regiment, if you like, one felt that, that I'm not going to be the chap who lets the bloody thing go, if I could possibly avoid it. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not your decision to whether it stays or not. But if you can influence the future of the thing, you do your utmost to try and do it. And everybody felt the same at the time. I mean, James would give me his advice, and Arthur would give me his advice.
Was it based on sentiment? Or the hard practical reasons why they should have the name South Knots Hussars in the unit title, even if it was infantry or parachutists or whatever the government...
Well, we had, of course, been in the past a number of different arms, in the sense that we were created as yeomanry cavalry. We were, for a time, machine gun corps. We've been a lot of different things. We've been gunners, cavalry, and... we took to the home defence in the best interest of saying, well, it's the South Knots Hussars, they're going to do a job, and we'll try and keep it going. And ultimately, we wanted to see it reformed as something with a better role. I mean, and we never thought the home defence role was going to be a sustainable role in the long term. So we felt that the only way we could actually get it together for something else was to be so strongly recruited that they just couldn't say, go. And that proved to be correct at the end of the day.